I want to go out with the voices of these forest heroes. In 2012, the United Nations posthumously recognized Maria and José da Silva as forest heroes, the couple murdered in 2011 while fighting to protect the rainforest. Maria's sister, Laísa Santos Sampio, received the award on their behalf. We'll end with her words.
Maria and José Claudio not only defended the forest, but showed by practical example how to live with dignity in the forest, respecting its dynamics and all its species. In living with the forest, they were examples and taught children that one has more to gain keeping the forest alive than selling or burning it.
That was Laísa Santos Sampio remembering her sister and brother-in-law, Maria and José da Silva, forest heroes. That does it for our show. Thanks so much to Oliver Courtney. We'll link to the report, Deadly Environment, at democracynow.org. Tonight, I'll be doing a public interview with the Chilean novelist Isabel Allende. Go to our website here in New York. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkner, Nafel Sarin, Mate Nirmin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, and Malcolm Hani Masood. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with our host, Paul Rowland. Today, we'll be talking about the first annual Cascadia Rising, a bioregional confluence.
Ear to the Streets of Portland is a dynamic broadcast with a mix of music and conversations focusing on organizers and Black African Portlanders around the city. Tune in into the next installment of Ear to the Streets of Portland with music and conversations featuring Michael Hicks of the Black Rose Books and the creator of the upcoming Portland Natural Hair Expo in May. Next installment of Ear to the Streets of Portland is Thursday, April 17th, starting at 7 o'clock p.m., right here on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, or online at www.kboo.fm.
People ask me everywhere, is that really all your hair?
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Sold Out Music Festival happening now until April 20th at venues all over Portland. The Sold Out Music Fest seeks to bring together people of all generations and backgrounds to celebrate the music that helps to bind our collective culture together. Legends of New Orleans jazz, the luminaries of Brooklyn hip-hop, the queen of modern soul music, and more are performing together under one banner. Bands, venues, bios, and more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale. Full Circle accepts like-new natural fiber clothing, jewelry, and accessories for consignment or store credit. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont, and on the web at gazellenaturalfiberclothing.com or fullcircleresaleportland.com.
I was born inside a hospital with a 9-digit number code. I pledged allegiance to the flag when I was only 4 years old. The first thing that I learned in school is we are a country free. One bad forces attack our land. I'll fight for my country. I'll fight for my country. I joined the Scouts when I was 12 and put on a uniform. I learned there how to fold the flag and how the look of a proud man was worn. We camped in the mountains, deserts and plains. We hiked through the giant trees. And I saw God in the beauty there. I'll fight for my country. I'll fight for my country. Young man walks all alone. 6,000 miles away he finds for the first time that he feels at home. And he laughs to himself as he faces his fear in the land of the mighty grizzly. It once was like this everywhere. I'll fight for my country. It once was like this everywhere.
Yeah, that was Dana Lyons, an oldie but goodie. Boy, I remember when he used to play that song around the campfire, the Earth First gatherings back in the day. My name's Paul. This is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio here on Community Radio, KBOO, Portland. And I'm with Lumen, live in the studio.
Good morning.
She's not a morning person, but she'll do her best.
No, I'm still waking up.
And we also have on the line from San Francisco, California, Judy Goldhaft. Are you with us?
I am.
Good morning.
I'm happy to be here.
And I meant to say that that song we played, My Country, from the great album Cows with Guns, which actually, that song, Cows with the Guns, actually became a minor hit on some country stations. Little did they know. And they were like up in arms about Earth First at the time. But it was kind of this subversive little thing that slipped in under the radar. Anyway, ancient history. So we are here to talk about Cascadia Rising, a bioregional confluence, which I think is a great name, confluence. I mean, kind of says it all. Confluence of rivers and...
Yeah, it's an evocative way to say conference, I think, but it does. It invokes waters and rivers and, you know, things coming together, which is exactly what we have in mind for Sunday.
And so, yeah, it is this Sunday, second floor of the Smith Memorial Union at Portland State University in downtown Portland. And we'll probably say it again, but CascadiaConfluence.org. That's the website, right? Yes. And I want to start out this program by talking with Judy, because, you know, you have a very long history in this bioregional, like, if you can call it a movement, or, you know, just talking about rooting in place, the idea of a bioregion as opposed to artificial constructs, political constructs. And you have a rich history. So I was hoping you could, I'm sure you've been called on to do this before. You've probably told your story numerous times, but I think our KBOO listeners probably have not heard it. But you were with the Diggers in San Francisco, and in, you know, my reading of bioregionalism, that's a big part of the history. It really emerges kind of out of, you know, that ferment of the 1960s obviously has much deeper roots. But the back to the land movement, a lot of the first people really starting to talk about bioregionalism were some of the people who came out of that milieu. Is that your understanding, Judy?
Yes, I actually believe I was looking through some of the old papers and things, and in fact, I would say that the roots of bioregional thinking are definitely happened with the rebellions that happened in the 60s, which were actually beginning to do open protests against industrial society. To put it in context, in the 60s, there was capitalism and there was socialism, and you had your choice which one you were part of. And in fact, both of those social organizations are based in industrial production and expansion for material progress. Both of them destroy the ecology, and both of them were kind of incapable of ending their Cold War conflict. So, and both of them also destroyed human individual freedoms. So the 60s rebellions actually began open protests against prohibitive laws regarding personal behavior. And what the 60s was exploring were new personal and social ideals. It was one of the Digger papers. The Diggers put out a lot of, we called them street sheets. They were like instant newsletters, and they were collected as an issue of The Realist, which was kind of very far out radical newsletter. He put a bunch of them together, and in it was a piece that Peter Berg wrote, in which he said, and this is a quote, "Wars against ecology are suicidal." And the editor of The Realist, whose name was Paul Krasner, said, "What does ecology mean? I've never heard this word before." Well, the word ecology actually was popularized in 1962 or so, when Silent Spring came out. I think that that's when ecology became part of the vocabulary. And so, yes, the beginnings of bioregionalism happen with the desire to change society that happened in the 60s. When the back to the land movement began, Peter Berg and I decided to visit all of the back to the landers and communal groups and find out what they were doing. And we made a trip in a house truck with a whole group, started out with a whole group of people, but ended up being just the two of us and our family, visiting many, many communal groups in North America and back to the landers. And every single place that we visited, there was some kind of ecological catastrophe going on. It was quite amazing. And as in the middle of this trip, Peter made a trip to the first UN conference on the environment. And he went, and lots of other people went, and it was people in the streets and people in the UN. And there was a big division between national interests, which happened as part of the, quote, UN conference on the environment, and the people who had come because they were concerned about the environmental destruction that was going on where they live. There were people from all over the world, and there was no place for them to speak at the UN conference for the environment.
And it's just continued like that, all the climate change talks and all that.
It's exactly the
people
same
do not thing. Have a voice in the decisions that affect us, that And it just gets more and more disastrous. I, Judy, I neglected to say that the reason we were actually talking to you is that you are going to be one of the speakers on Sunday at the conference. Minor detail. And so you're going to be talking about this history. And, you know, so let's just put it out there. You know, I know Lumen's in here, and she's going to talk about the conference, specifically what the panels are, some of the speakers, talk about, you know, why this conference, what the goals of it are and all that. But I was really hoping to have you, since you have this long, rich history, and, you know, you were around when people really first started using this term, bioregionalism. Just give us a thumbnail. What does that mean for people who may not be familiar with it?
Well, the term bioregion is self-defining. It's bio, life, region, place. So you could replace the word bioregion with life place. And it's essentially an idea that bioregions at this time, bioregions have been damaged. Most bioregions are somewhat damaged, and it's time for us to recognize the flora, the fauna, the climate, the geology, all the things that make our life place what it is. And there are actually, life places are different in different places. They're not political borders. The Great Lakes are a bioregion, and they go over the Canadian border. So they're not political boundaries. But they're planetary boundaries. They are actually, if you look at Google Earth, you can see the bioregions. They pop out as individual places. So bioregions also include not just the scientific, biological, geological definition of a place, but also they include human beings and human culture. So people can adapt to their bioregion and live in place with the biology of the place, or they can exploit it and destroy it. So,
which has pretty much been the, the
yes,
ruling principle for
that.
Quite a while. And and people have been talking about this for a long time, and obviously the forces that continue the destruction, not only don't listen, I think it's such a threat to their basic, like, I don't know, the structure of their the constitution, of their, like, personal social constitution. I mean, we're so deeply socialized in these, you know, these artificial ways of relating to things. Anyway, we'll not wax philosophical here. You guys can do that. So we're talking about bioregionalism. We're talking about Cascadia, which is the name that was given for this bioregion, and maybe Lumen, you can talk about what that means. But I just want to, while we're talking, before we open it up for callers, which we're going to do in about 5 minutes, I just think it's really intriguing that your personal history of the diggers, because that's such a really interesting part of, you know, this whole legacy of the 1960s. Just tell us briefly what the diggers were all about, and how that really informed your, you know, the rest of your life, really, your view, your worldview.
Well, the diggers had two things that they were doing. They were exploring society and how human beings can live together. And the diggers said, everything is free, and do your own thing. So that's about freedom, actually. And the diggers tried to use the Summer of Love as an experiment to see what was the best things, what things could you do if you didn't have to depend on having a job and going to work all the time. How could you live the most beautiful life you could possibly live? And this was an independent possibility. That's what we explored. That's what the diggers explored. We provided, we had free food, we had free housing, we had free art, we had free news, we had free events, we had free music in the parks. And if you didn't have to pay for them, then what would you do with your time? So the do-your-own thing was figure out who you are and what you really want to do with your life.
And it just, of course, since then, of course, the, you know, the rise in the cost of living, the continual eroding of our personal liberties and all that has made it more and more difficult. And people, it's like if you don't have that, the feeling I get about that time was just there's this just this greater, this explosion of, like you say, experimentation and opening up a social space, like people congregating in public spaces. Occupy brought that back briefly, but I mean, that was like really just a widespread phenomenon back then. I mean, if just any films you see or books you read really points to that, but it's just been this closing down because obviously the power trippers, the status quo sees that, understandably sees that as a threat and closes it down, which we saw with Occupy. So with that, I know you've also had a long history since. You and your partner Peter Berg started the Planet Drum Foundation, which was intended to spread this idea of bioregionalism, and it had a newspaper and, you know, which with articles from all over the continent and various other continents talking about this. Just talk about how, since, you know, the time you're talking about and that explosion of freedom and experimentation, how that informed your work and, you know, pretty much, you know, in a brief nutshell, because we really need to open up the phone lines for callers to explore these with them also.
Well, that's what I'm looking for. Yeah. I'm looking forward to this confluence because it, using the word confluence as in the title of this gathering is wonderful to me because I feel that the way that society has to evolve is with ecology and humans working mutually together. And I'm hoping that this confluence is a confluence of information about what kinds of things people are doing today that are moving us into a new society where we are mutualistically living in the place where we are and not destroying it. And this has happened lots of places. As a matter of fact, Portland was one of the first places that had a newspaper about this call. It was a newsletter called Rain. And there are lots of restoration projects. There are lots of social projects. There are things like in the Mattole in Northern California. There's a restoration councils. There are groups all over that are looking into moving forward with the earth rather than destroying the earth. There are bioregional groups all over, and people have begun working with the transition movements too. They understand that it's obvious that the transition movement is working in a similar way to make the places where we live more sustainable. So I'm really interested in hearing what Lumen has to say about what's going to happen on Sunday, since besides my talking and maybe doing a performance, I don't know what's happening.
Well, with that, Lumen?
Yeah. If I could go back just a little bit and kind of reflect on a tiny bit about what Judy said, you know, I think it's interesting that you, Paul, just mentioned the Occupy movement, because in some ways I feel like the roots of this confluence happened with Occupy. And at the time of Occupy, I was a forest activist here in the Northwest, a long tradition that I know you share as well, Paul. And Cascadia was a term for the bioregion, you know, the temperate coastal rainforest, watersheds flowing through those rainforests, and like the greater Columbia River drainage, and that really unique, that unique ecoregions up here where I live. And so it was a term for these places and things that I loved, and it was a term to describe this place outside of this, like these very like colonial and empire and United States of America, Canada type descriptions that I was not such a fan of, as I'm sure many people who are listening and will be there Sunday have their critiques of our the empire and the industrial civilization which we live in. So I really resonated with the idea of Cascadia, and I don't think I was the only one. And I know, as someone who was participating in the Occupy movement here in Portland, that Cascadia flag was everywhere, and it was a symbol of it was very much a symbol of the alternative as business as usual, that I think people had come to expect from the status quo. And in that opening of space, where you know a lot of the people who now are working on this conference and people who at the time of the Occupy movement here in Portland, you know, people who came to Portland, people that I met as part of that movement, that's people started talking, well, we need some sort of gathering. And so a lot of the people who were working on the Sunday, this is several years later, the culmination of that. And it's a broad scope, obviously, talking about the way that people live in a healthy way. There's a really going to be a really broad scope of topics on Sunday, because of, I think, where people are at. We're talking about emergency preparedness and sustainability. We're going to be exploring decision making structures and governance. There's going to be a talk from Sociocracy, which is an interesting decision-making type of thing. I think that a lot of here, specifically in the Pacific Northwest, we're dealing with a pretty racist legacy. And here, I'd say on this entire continent, we're dealing with some pretty deep legacies of colonialism. And so we really tried to centralize that when we came up with the schedule of this conference. And there will be workshops. Rose City Antifa is coming in and talking about combating white supremacy here in Cascadia. There's going to be panels on appropriate uses of ancestral technology and how to avoid cultural appropriation when engaging in you know, practices and skills and crafts that really, you know, get people more intimate with their land base. What else is going to happen? There's going to be a couple of panels and workshops talking about different kinds of governance and indigenous rights, and ways that people who are here who are dealing with the legacy of being settlers on this place can be in better allyship, and how to better be in relationship with land-based dealing with that legacy. Climate chaos and Cascadia, that's one that I'm personally presenting on, but it's, yeah, talking about like the effects that climate chaos are gonna have on this land base and how we can deal with that and how we can resist those large infrastructure pieces that they're trying to put in here and like mitigate and deal with the effects that climate change is having on the landscape as a whole.
So other than the actual panels, are there other activities, other spaces for?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it says from 9:30 a.m. till 5:30 p.m.?
Yeah, 9:30 to 5:30. There's going to be a lot of open space throughout the day. I know that people are coming in from as far north, I've heard, as Vancouver, British Columbia, and people coming in, I think, from, you know, the southern Oregon region. So there's going to be a lot of people from across the bioregion, and there's going to be a lot of open space, a lot of groups tabling, hopefully a lot of fertile, interesting conversations in and of itself. I'm really excited, Judy, because I understand that you're going to do a water web dance, and that sounds like one of the more interesting offerings of the day. Lona seems really excited about it, and I'm mostly curious. But yeah, Judy's going to close out the day with that at 4:30, and that should be really interesting.
So maybe you should say a little bit, not, you know, give us the whole thing, but entice us with what you're going to do then.
Okay. WaterWeb is talking and moving, giving a lot of information about water and our relationship to it. I'll give you the first line of it. Okay?
I'm ready.
Here it goes. Water, by its nature, seeks a spherical form, but loving all things equally gives itself to any shape.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it goes on. I think information-wise, let's see, one time I gave it and somebody said, my God, I had a class in hydrology and you covered everything.
Oh, wow.
But I think it's really just a drop in the bucket. There's so much about water, so much we don't know, and so much we love.
Well, thank you for that. And you can come and participate in that again this Sunday at Portland State University. And I'm speaking with Judy Goldhaft on the phone from San Francisco. As I said, a longtime bioregional activist and organizer with her late companion, Peter Berg, and with the Planet Drum Foundation, a member of the Diggers in San Francisco in the 1960s, and many other things. And you can find out about her and meet her in person on Sunday. She'll be giving a presentation about the history and nature of bioregionalism. And I'm speaking with Lumen, who's a co-organizer of Cascadia Rising. And it is 8:31 here on your community radio station, KBOO. And I'm Paul Rowland, and I'm the host for this Wednesday. This is a open slot since Lisa Loving left. We still haven't settled on a regular host, but I've been doing it some. And I would like to open up the phone lines. That's 503-231-8187. Got a message here. Oh, I need to repeat where the event will be. That's at Portland State University Smith Memorial Union, second floor.
Uh-huh, right. Downtown Portland, Portland State University is so kindly hosting us, which is really awesome. And we're going to be in the Smith Memorial Union right there on campus in the second floor.
And again, that's Sunday, April 20, this coming Sunday. And the number is 503-231-8187. If you have any questions for Lumen or Judy or comments, please give us a call.
I've heard that there are going to be watershed reports from people at the confluence. I'm looking forward to them.
Oh yeah, I remember. I remember this from about 20 years ago when I used to go to these things. Yeah, that was an aspect. I mean, people were really enthusiastic about the idea of, you know, watershed-based participatory democracy. You know, that was, you know, there's a lot.
That says it all, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's like a real powerful alternative model, and it certainly went a certain way. But then there was this kind of, you know, subtle and then not so subtle sort of co-optation of the watershed participatory decision making model by various institutions. That sort of, you know, it never, you know, obviously it's a hard fight no matter what. All these things are very difficult. Getting people to, weaning ourselves. Not, I don't mean to make this separate myself. Weaning ourselves away from these, you know, imperial forms of delegating authority and decision making to centralized powers that then tend to make very bad decisions is, you know, it's difficult, and it's difficult to get people together to create these public spaces, to create these forums. We saw how difficult it was with Occupy. And then add on to the fact that the, as I said, the, you know, the institutional powers kind of catch on that people are actually doing that there's a bit of a groundswell. So then they kind of take it over. So these watershed groups, this kind of, like, I think Laura Nader coined the term coercive harmony, where everybody's kind of like, oh, why can't we all just get along? And then subtly the agenda is actually set by some sort of institutional force, and people like are forced to sort of like accept the agenda if you're going to participate. And anyway, could go on and on, but it's a wonderful thing. So, and the idea of actually people coming in from their different regions to a, you know, kind of spokes, the whole spokes model, which Lisa Fithian talked about when I interviewed her a couple months ago. So, anyway, I can go on, but we have one caller on the line. And BJ. Hello, BJ. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah.
I'm not BJ. Okay. Can I speak?
Go ahead.
Okay, I was going to bring up something and ask an opinion about an event that's happening, or was happening in Nevada, about a cattle rancher and a standoff, et cetera, but I think I won't. You know, I used to go to a lot of different kinds of political events in the 1990s and thereafter in Portland at PSU and other places, and I generally, as a low-income public housing person and getting food stamps, et cetera, I never felt comfortable or welcome. That might be my personal problem, but I'll put it out there and see what you have to say. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for asking that question. I think we forgot to mention that the whole conference is free.
I think maybe she meant, I'm not sure exactly what she meant, because she didn't really go into it, not feeling welcome. I mean, yeah, I mean, there's problems of cultural differences and insensitivities. I don't know. Yeah, it's difficult to put yourself out there to begin with, and then, you know, I don't know.
Well,
Judy?
Bioregionally, you want diversity. You do want to include all people. So I'm sorry to hear that that was a problem for our caller, and I hope that's not going to happen in the future.
Likewise. And we do have another caller. Now we have BJ. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah.
Are you there?
We sure are. We're waiting.
Please. I know I like Lisa Loving. Do you know why she left?
I think it was a conflict with her work.
Right, yeah, that could be a problem. It's one of the things why I don't work down there so much as a conflict with my health. Say, I want to go to this at the university. Where is it going to be? What's the address? Is that the one on the east side or the west side? What college or university is it?
It's downtown Portland.
Okay. And how would I get there?
Any bus line. It's right just a two blocks from the bus mall. So.
Uh-huh.
Or the MAX that goes down to, there's actually a tram or whatever that goes to Portland State too. Can't get a place that's more public transportation accessible.
Oh, it's wonderful. You're doing good work to get it out there for people to, especially to have things without big charges, where you get social events going on. They're knowledgeable. I used to go to them in the 60s and play drums. I loved it. I played drums with a lot of things. But I just wanted to ask a few questions to people. Do they want to make any comments about it for us listeners that want to go? Come there to you on the 20th?
Yeah. I'm not. You have a question, you said?
If they want to say something to a young 80-year-old that wants to go down there, okay?
Okay.
Come, we will look forward to seeing you there.
Oh, that's great.
Yes, please. And I have an address. Smith Memorial Union is at 1825 Southwest Broadway, too.
Okay, 1825 Southwest Broadway. Broadway, right. Okay, that's down there and past the Elk. And as you go up, you know, I've lived here a long time, but getting around the city is a little problem.
Well, I'm sure, you know, whatever bus line or wherever you are, you can ask and they'll be able to find it.
Thank you very
okay.
much for that. Have a good.
Okay, thanks for calling. We do have another caller. Brian? Hello, Brian?
Yeah. Hi, good morning. Thank you for having this, and I'm hoping I can make the convergence. I'm not exactly sure yet, but I also wanted to just say the model, I tuned in just about 5 minutes ago, so just coming in late on the conversation. I don't know everything that's been discussed, but the watershed model is really similar to what we used when we started organizing the Green Party. And it's been part of the Green Party, really, ideas of how do we transform society, and one of them would be in watersheds. The one thing I see that I just want to throw out there, and I'm and I'm glad this is happening, but one thing I keep seeing or feeling after 20 years of trying to organize at these different levels is we still think too large. And, you know, when we come together, just like at Occupy, when you try to throw 5,000 people or 1,000 people together to make decisions when they have no background together, no trust that they've built up, no experience together, it just becomes chaos almost. And I've lived in I helped in the 90s create a co-housing community and know what it's like to try to get 30 families together to make decisions collectively. And it takes a lot of work and a lot of time and a lot of experience and a lot of individual growth in people who come together that they have to be willing to understand that their approach to life and living in an individualistic way may not work in a cooperative group way. So we've got so much to learn if we're going to make these things work. And I guess actually experiencing them and doing them is just one way to start that learning.
Yeah, thank you. I think that people a lot of times ask some, they're like, well, the Cascadia movement, that's like too broad. And what does that mean? And is it a political movement? Is it a movement for secession? Like, is it just some like tree loving environmentalism or like, what does this mean? I guess from my perspective, and it'd be interesting to hear Paul and Judy's thoughts. You have to go local in order to have the kind of decision making scale that you're talking about, you know, like we need different political organization and some level, and we need more local political organization, and we need communities that have more local and intimate relationships with the land base that they're on in order to have what you're talking about. And additionally, I think that when you talk about that kind of need to make those shifts, those psychological shifts and those like cultural change shifts, I think that that's there's like a whole umbrella of people and things and actual, like, you know, projects and movements that fall under kind of the Cascadia umbrella. And some of it's political, some of it more than others. It means a lot of different things to different people, but a lot of what it is also those like types of cultural shifts. And I think that that's a huge part of bioregionalism, is looking at different ways of people interactions with people and ways that we can form different community models in ways that are, you know, prevent the kind of problems that you sounds like you've seen and that I know that I've personally seen with issues with decision making and people just not really having the psychological capacity to pull off their ambitious, lofty political goals.
Well, one thing I would say, and that sounds great, and, you know, as you were talking, one thing I hope you guys spend a lot of time on and stuff it's called shared visions. Like, what's your vision, you know, and what's my vision? And what you'll find is just by talking about vision, we do start to blend together. What I see so much energy in our going towards is, what are we opposed to? You know, and when we have that kind of energy, it's not really creative energy, because it doesn't help us create the things that we actually need going forward and the new institutions, the new ways of thinking, new ways of being. And by just spending a lot of energy on what's your vision, and those shared visions as they come together can act as a pulling towards what do we want. If our shared vision was we're going to take care of all the kids in this community, then energy will start to coalesce. Well, how are we going to do that? And it'll be outside of the box. It won't be inside the box. Well, it's got to happen at schools or something. It'll be like, oh, you know, maybe we create something new that doesn't even exist right now. But that's the thing we need going forward if we're going to take care of all the kids in this community, for instance. So shared visions. I'll get off. Thank you very much for listening, and I look forward to hearing this conversation.
Great. Thank you, Brian.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Yeah, absolutely, Brian. And I think that what you're saying about visions is, to me, what's so resonant about the bioregional movement and also specifically Cascadia is that it can provide a place for positive visions for people who a lot of times are mostly like against a lot of terrible things that are happening in this world.
The bioregional point of view is definitely a proactive rather than a reactive mode of thinking. I wrote to some of the people in Occupy because they wondered what was next. And I think that after occupying a community
a community occupying a space, then the community has to really explore where their life place is, and they have to re-inhabit the place where they live to really explore it on a deep level and build community from the ground up. I spoke to some of the people at Occupy, and they felt that their decision-making process just didn't work. It was too big. I agree. So,
and that was the voice, again, of Judy Goldhaft, and she's on the line from San Francisco. And I also have in the studio Lumen. And then we have a couple more callers, but before we go to them, coming up on this morning on KBOO at 9, we'll hear Economic Update with host Richard Wolff. His guest is Nomi Prinz, ex-Goldman Sachs banker and author of the new book, All the President's Bankers. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15, Flashpoints celebrates the 65th birthday of Pacifica Radio's KPFA with a reading given by the late poet and activist June Jordan during the 1991 Gulf War. Plus, we'll hear an excerpt from a recent speech by theoretical physicist Michio Kaku. And 11, The Food Show hosts an interview with Laura Pacheco, author of Seed and Thistle Apothecary. They'll also talk with Jeannie Marshall, author of The Lost Art of Feeding Kids. And they interview Mary Weaver Chapin, the curator of graphic arts at the Portland Art Museum, about the Feast and Famine exhibition currently on display. And as always, thanks KBOO members for your generous support for this radio station. Not a current member, become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. With that, we have Harry on the line.
Yes, good morning, everyone. Good morning. And thank you for this insightful discussion. Especially when you mentioned Cascadia, I assume the name came from the Cascade Mountains. And I was wondering if your confluence will be talking about pollution. The Cascadia, we live in the Willamette Valley here. We have the Willamette River, which is the second largest river in the western United States. We're trying to clean up this river, but in the 1980s the main issue we had was Hua Cheng, and this company had this pipe going right out to the middle of the Willamette River and dumping pollution. I assumed that the Clean Water Act would have taken care of anyone dumping in the Willamette River, but it doesn't. There's a lot of companies that are still dumping in the Willamette River. Will you be talking about pollution? Water pollution.
It sounds like a great topic to bring to a watershed report back.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, this is in the spirit of do your own thing. Yeah, I mean, this is basically the result of a fairly relatively small group of volunteer people basically putting together a limited number of panels in a limited amount of space. And I could probably name 10 to 100 right off the bat that aren't going to be included because you can't include everything. But, you know, it's up to the people who come, I assume, to contribute their interests. So come and bring your experience and knowledge and concerns, and hopefully you can find a space for them and certainly find other people to talk to about them, if nothing else, I imagine.
Hey, thank you very much.
Yeah, I would think that at a confluence, if there can be watershed reports, the purpose of them would be both informational, to let people know what's going on, and also coalition building so that people can help each other with the problems like pollution in their particular area.
And we have one more caller. James? Hello?
Good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to comment that I really appreciated hearing, I don't remember which of your guests said this, but it was equating capitalism with socialism, both being industrial economies. And, you know, I was raised to equate capitalism with liberty, I think these are very important things to address, that these lies that we have been brought up with, and because it keeps us divided. And I think it's very important that we do focus on freedom and liberty and things like that. And so, I just wanted to say that I appreciate
and responsibility and mutual accountability as well.
Yes, yes, that's what liberty is all about.
Well, it may or may not be, depends on how you define it.
We're still exploring it. Mm-hmm. We're still exploring what liberty is. You know, recently there are, we've worked a lot with human rights in the U.S., but in South America, two countries just added to their constitutions rights of nature as well. So besides human rights, plants and animals also have rights now in those countries.
Well, thank you for calling.
Go
ahead.
Thank you.
We have one more thing to say?
No, I think that's all I have. Thank you.
Okay, because we have one more caller, and we're coming down to the last 10 minutes. Jean, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. I wanted to say thank you to your guest for feeding me when I was living in San Francisco in my early 20s. I went to the Diggers and they in the Panhandle and got breakfast on a number of occasions.
This is what I love about radio, hearing things like this.
And I've tried to follow in that model a bit, but it's been extremely difficult. I had to, you know, go back to school, get a degree, and, you know, join the mad race for money so that I could retire, which when I think of that trajectory, that's kind of scary. But my question is how you know, when you were talking about capitalism and socialism being two sides of the same coin, that's fascinating, and I want to know more about that. But how does this electronic revolution fit into it? Because it seems to me that's the one that has taken over and that does dominate our lives and is extremely capitalistic and is extremely energy not efficient. So what are some thoughts on that and how to incorporate that into what the ecological restoration movement?
Now, there's a big question for you.
Well, you know, when technology was 20 years ago beginning, one of the first things that Peter Berg noted was that there was a lot of garbage that was collected as things were updated. Things were updated, and so the old was to be thrown out. Mm-hmm. So there was incredible amounts of technological garbage. And also, the processes to make various parts of computers and things was very toxic. Mm-hmm. And it took quite a while. It took about 10 or 15 years before any kinds of recognition of that began to be made. I think that I'm hoping that people will go more for long-term usage of things like computers rather than turning them in every 3 years because they're outmoded. Mm-hmm. That's really that's a big problem.
Yeah,
I believe that's a big problem.
So do you see poverty for the masses as kind of driving a turning away from capitalism, that we don't have to have a new car every 27 seconds and we don't have to have new all the time, that we will go more to recycle restoration if the wages, I mean, I've wondered about this, if we don't have a lot of money, I think we're a lot more careful with what we use.
And we prefer things that last a long time rather than things that fall apart in 6 months.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's part of the new industrial Buy American that's been going on, is hopefully the products will be of better quality.
Oh, good point.
Well, thank you very much for calling.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It. And I realize I once again neglected to repeat the phone number, and we only have about 5 minutes left, but I will do it. It's 503-231-8187. And I just want to ask Lumen, because this is really resonant sub heading or whatever for the continents. Oh,
yeah. It's resist, restore, re-inhabit. And I think it speaks to that. Technology is such an interesting question because in addition to the really destructive ecological effects that Judy just mentioned, I think it profoundly affects the way that we interact with each other socially, our human social interactions. And I'm from a generation, I'm just barely old enough to really remember what it was like before computers. I don't think that my younger sisters remember that. But I think that, you know, like that's hence that a bioregional movement is about a lot more than just those ecological effects, but it's about the ways that those uses of technology like really profoundly affect our social space and our minds and our relationships.
And that's a conversation that can really only happen more thoroughly in, you know, on an ongoing basis, like kind of, you know, face-to-face conversations. It's really difficult to do this over in its own way, a somewhat alienating technological form. Although radio is really, it's kind of interesting. It's a little different because it's got the sort of nearness of the human voice, which is illusory in a sense, but also real. And it kind of does draw together. I always thought the cable listening area was kind of sort of bioregional its own way because we go out to into the gorge and we go down the Willamette River down towards Corvallis and Philomath, and you know it kind of has the potential to draw us together. I'm not sure we've fully utilized it, but again, I'm going on talking. I know Lumen wants to say some last things here, but we have one more caller on the line. Anthony, you're on the air, Anthony.
Oh, good morning, Saves. I know you're coming to the end of this show, and I have a lot to say about a lot of things, but particularly on technology, the way it was defined in terms of computer use and those applications and all. I just wanted to throw something out there, that Apple is putting a data center in Prineville, Oregon, and it's going to use about 60 megawatts of power off of one of the dams up on the Columbia River. So I hope that you guys are also including the Columbia River and its destruction of the fish and all of that lifestyle activity that happened hundreds of years ago. My wife's father was a commercial fisherman, and once the dams went in, he fished out of El Waco. He noticed the decline in the salmon over the years. So it's not the big guys or the small guys getting back. It's the kids trying to get out the river that get chewed up. So as we think about using our computers and our phones and all that data stuff, we also must think about the fish and how they're impacted by our use of data centers that use about 60, 70, 80, who knows how many megawatts of power. Anyway, thanks for doing what you're doing. I love KBOO, and have a good day. Bye now.
Great point.
So I want to say two things. One is face-to-face is not face-to-face anymore. Face-to-face is texting. When you're... People barely look at each other because they're texting all the time. It's pretty interesting.
Well, texting's
so
pretty.
I think the social impacts of technology are really important. We have big buses that go through my neighborhood and go down to Silicon Valley. Peter Berg called them slave ships. They are enormous. People get on them and they start working. They have Wi-Fi. They are slave ships. And one other thing I'd like to say is that a friend of mine recently retired, and he said retiring is really like in a motor car race where they come into the pit and they put new tires on and they go back out again. That's the kind of retirement he wants to do. So use your retirement to do good things.
Okay, well, thank you, Jody. We really only have a minute left, so I know Lumen has some final things to...
Great. Well, just to wrap up, I hope to see everyone there Sunday, Cascadia Rising, a bioregional confluence. Please check out our website, CascadiaConfluence.org, C-A-S-C-A-D-I-A, Confluence.org. Please go on our website, register, RSVP online, and enter our raffle. We've got some great prizes. Sunday, April 20th, this Sunday, 9:30 to 5:30 p.m., Portland State University and the Smith Memorial Union.
Thank you so much, Lumen, and thank you so much, Judy Goldhaff from San Francisco. And also, our website is kboo.fm. I'll have all the links to this if you want to go there as well. My name is Paul Rowland. Thank you so much for listening to Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. Stay tuned for Economic Update with host Richard Wolf on KBOO.
When our children are old, they'll know land can't be sold.
KBOO is a co-sponsor of Cascadia Rising, a bioregional confluence, this Sunday, April 20. All day at Portland State University. Part of PSU's Earth Week activities, the theme of the gathering is Resist, Restore, Reinhabit. The event is free and will feature a full slate of panels, including a history of the bioregional movement, emergency preparedness and community resilience, bioregional governance, biocentric resistance, and much more. For more about the event and a full schedule, go to cascadiaconfluence.org or go to their Facebook page. Again, that's Cascadia Rising this Sunday, April 20, beginning at 9:30 a.m. on the second floor of Portland State's Smith Memorial Union on Southwest Broadway in downtown Portland.
No tyranny, no tyranny, we'll make a true democracy. Soon one day Cascadia shall be free.
Our jails and prisons have become overcrowded with people suffering from mental illness. Many people incarcerated are also addicted to drugs and alcohol. What treatment is being provided? Tune in to Prison Pipeline April 14th to hear Doyle Smith of Dual Diagnosis Anonymous of Oregon talk about the need for treatment programs in our jails and prisons. That's Prison Pipeline April 14th at 6:30 p.m.
Good morning, it's 9:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM. Coming right up,